It is Saturday, December 21st, 2013. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Hey, welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. We're not saying one way or the other. Do not assume. That's what I am saying. Who am I? I'm Bonnie Primsch. I'm in the host chair today. And with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, programmer, photographer, father, and sometimes radio host.
That's true. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. How's it going? Also with us, Ben Jaffe, a technology teacher, musician, and web developer. Hey, Ben.
Hey, don't shoot the messenger. I've got some bad news.
Uh-oh.
I woke up this morning, or rather, I woke up very slowly this morning. I was really enjoying when the sun was not up. Well, unfortunately, it is the shortest day of the year, which means every day from now until 6 months from now will be less and less nighttime.
Are you a nocturnal fellow? Is that what I'm picking
up here?
I'm not
sure if this is optimistic or pessimistic or sad or weird.
I don't know how to feel.
I'm so confused. Luckily, the day will be over soon.
I like sleeping. That's all I'm saying.
All right. And it's easier to do when it's dark out.
So happy shortest day of the... there's a word for this. Winter solstice. Happy winter solstice, everyone.
Right on.
Way to use a term that already is there. Well, gang, today for the show, we wanted to kind of take a look back over the year and ferret out what were kind of the key developments in geekery for 2013 and discuss a little bit how they might impact us going forward. That's our overarching theme for the show.
We normally do this kind of the idea of wrapping up the year at the end of the last show of the year. There is one more show. Next week's show will be a pre-recorded show because we're all on break. Mm-hmm. And Ben, it's an interview with whom?
Vienna Tang, fantastic musical artist and a geek, in fact.
And so you did the interview. I haven't actually heard it yet. I'm really excited about hearing it while I'm on vacation, so looking forward to that. And so therefore, this is our wrap of the year in the review, which we've done for years. And yeah... one of the things that we do at GeekSpeak is kind of translate the tech stuff into meaning for the everyday person. Mm-hmm. This year, I feel like, has been an excessively important technical year.
Well, it's just been a huge amount of developments and also some uncomfortable pulling back of the, you know, what's behind the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. So let's go through some simple ones first. You know, this year was the first year that DNA sequencing was possible for personal choice. You know, at something like $100, something like that, you can actually get your DNA mapped, or they take a sample and they give you some data back. And that's kind of amazing. During GeekSpeak, we heard there's a genome project, and hopefully within 20 years, they'll be able to map the human genome. And then a year and a half later, they've mapped the human genome.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Whoa.
Whoa, that's so fast.
Yeah, that's during
the
last...
And so now it's available to anyone who's got $100.
Yeah, and it'll probably get cheaper, and there'll be competitors and all that, and cover a few stories. I'm talking, you know, mostly about 23andMe, I think that's called.
It doesn't map your entire genome, though.
No.
It just looks at certain markers for certain types of
things. I don't know if it does map or not. I think it does. I think you get
a
full sequencing.
Possible health stuff on the horizon and also a little bit of ancestry.
Really?
It's a full sequencing of your genome. Yeah, they know what all your pairs are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every single one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I follow a repo on somebody that took his genome and was like, here's my genome, and put it in GitHub and like uploaded it. It's pretty big.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So what happens
cool.
when you get a pull request? Someone wants to
change
it.
I did a dupe. I cloned his repo. Exactly. I didn't
make
a change.
So you basically cloned the guy's sequence?
Yeah.
Now you can use it for good or evil.
I just thought it was kind of neat. Anyway, mainstream adoption of sequencing. And that's going to cause, you know, that social ramifications are pretty intense. We've talked a lot about that throughout the year. And I think that's going to be one of those ones that we'll see more come up over time.
Another thing that happened is, although it's been developing over time for a while, also during the span of GeekSpeak, the flight to get everyone into space
has
really taken up some steam. You've got several private companies working on the project. You've got Virgin Galactic. You've got your SpaceX.
Non-governmental space stuff is real. Mm-hmm. Is real.
And more governments are getting into the act also.
Yeah, I mean,
getting
Just in the last couple of years, the U.S. has significantly dialed down its space program, and so private industry has stepped in, which some people were like, that's a bad idea. But I'm kind of happy about this because it means we will be continuing to explore.
It's still happening. That's
absolutely. Yeah. Strangely enough, also, all of a sudden, after, I think, 40 years, I think, we're suddenly interested in the moon again. So this is the
moons and just
first,
rocks.
Yeah, the first soft landing in almost 40 years, and that was China landing a rover on the moon. So
cool.
We'll see if the moon becomes exciting again or what.
It's funny. I don't want myself or any of my immediate family to go to Mars, but the moon, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, the moon.
You know, if my kids got into that, I'd be like, yeah, do it.
What's the breaking point for you? Just like time.
Mars, just you don't get the radiation protection of the magnetosphere of Earth.
Oh, I see.
You also the duration of time. You know, basically, you go to Mars, either you stay there permanently or you come back and you die of cancer. Like those are your choices.
Yeah.
and going into Mars doesn't mean you're not going to die of cancer. I mean, let me tell you. And that's, you know, I think that's a long way out. But the moon, no, hop into the moon, come back. I mean, Buzz is doing fine, right?
He's done it.
He's
chilling out. I think it's Earth orbit for me. Yeah. Once you go outside of Earth orbit, that's just...
It is really... I mean, low orbit stuff is safe, right? Because you still have that protection in some sense.
Yeah, eventually you're going
to
come
once
down.
Once you go to the moon, you're actually getting a lot more dangerous, but you can do it short time. So
yeah.
It's kind of the... But the other thing is the moon has this amazing resource, right? It's another body close by, and there's a lot of materials there. And we
that tell us something about our own planet, right?
Because
isn't it just like it's an offshoot of our own planet?
Like that. A little droplet of Earth.
Yes, a little sploot of Earth that kind of became its own thing.
And you know, the other thing is you get an Earthrise on the moon. So instead of seeing the moon rise or the sunrise, you get the sunrise and the Earth rise. And I would love to see that in my lifetime.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty partial to Earth. I like it a lot.
It's cool. I like this planet.
I think we kind of need to see that rise over the horizon.
What about, I mean, this is sort of a new development also. I'm not sure what it means for space exploration, but just the idea of let's land on an asteroid.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about asteroids.
Like, we haven't really thought of it. It sounds fairly humble as a goal, but
it's a
could
hard
be
thing
very
to do.
Useful. It's a good practice run for other things.
Additionally, you know, when we talk about, well, it's just, you know, one other body that's close enough to get to is really the big thing. When I was chatting about the story ideas for today, I mentioned it to Maggie, and she said, and don't forget, you know, you can also do faster than light space travel soon. Because we covered the story. I don't know if you guys remember this story.
About bending, just scrunching time?
Like, yeah, warping space and time.
Alcubierre drive?
Yeah.
The warp, that's the French name for warp drive.
we covered warp drive technologies a few episodes ago when Brian and I last did the show, and we closed it out with that. Since then, it's been clear that the only thing you really need, it was really exciting because NASA was going to do it, right? But the only thing you really need is 2 tons of negative mass material. So that's all you need.
That's easy to come.
I'll just go pick some up at the Home Depot. Right.
Are you talking about antimatter?
Yeah. Well, no. It's a material that would be... I mean, the thing is the equations all work great with low energy, assuming you have this stuff, which we don't think
it
exists.
God, I should listen to Geek Speak more
often.
All
you need is pixie dust and everything works. Okay, so we're going to cover, of course, security and privacy and things of that nature.
Those seem to be like
big
beefy developments.
Definitely. But first, let me mention one more small one.
Yeah. Oh, I just had a quick addition to the warp drive story, which is I think about 6 months ago I saw a story on warp drive on theoretically you would need a spacecraft that looked roughly like this that had this big ring thing. And that was the first ship that Earth encountered in Star Trek, Vulcan.
The Vulcan ship had a ring,
which I just thought was awesome.
So
I
should have been here on that episode of Geek Speak when we talked about the warp drive.
I would have had so much to say.
Loved it.
Well, maybe we'll do it some more. Okay, so one other thing that I thought was kind of important. I mean, we're going to cover a couple in the next parts of the shows. That's cryptocurrencies and privacy and security issues. Those are large topics. But before we do that... new operating system. In this last year, a mainstream operating system has emerged. Now
at first, when I first heard, because I get as the non-geeky, as the least geeky of the set here, I get confused about simple things like operating system versus browser.
right.
Who cares, Chrome? I wasn't paying attention. But
that's actually a part of a confusion that people are having about this.
Yeah.
This.
Yeah.
So,
and the lines are a little bit more blurry.
Sure. Yeah. So for quite a while, we've had basically at stores, you could go in and you could buy a Macintosh or you could buy a Windows machine. Now, there has been Unix or Ubuntu installs for a while. You could actually buy those. But you kind of had to know you needed that and you wanted that. You had to be a geek to do that.
Exactly.
But for the mainstream, you've had two choices. Then over the last, you know, 5 years, we've seen iOS devices and other simpler devices, tablets,
phones and tablets,
kind of emerged.
Yeah.
This year, besides Macintosh, or besides Apple doing the iOS being mainstream, a whole bunch more tablets have come online, and those have different operating systems potentially. But we now have a new large player in the space. Google has an operating system, and that is the Chrome OS, not the same as the Chrome browser.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's confusing. Now, Chrome OS basically says, here's an operating system that's not Windows, it's not Macintosh, therefore it's not the viruses that happen on Windows don't happen here. It's a new type of environment. It's a new operating system for a laptop. And that operating system happens to basically just run the Chrome browser. That's all it does, which works for Google's methodology of everything they own. Yeah, everything they host, and you participate in their cloud.
Yeah. The idea, of course, is as web technologies become more and more powerful, you find that more things that you need to do that you needed applications to do on an operating system, you can actually just do on the web. Like, you don't need a mail client on your computer. You can use the Gmail client or the Yahoo Mail client or something like that. Right. So that's the idea behind it, is that theoretically everything you need to do, you can do on the web. You can even do video editing or picture editing if you want to.
Now, there are games you can't play on operating system. The operating system boundaries really define games and large applications. Like Photoshop's available on Macintosh and Windows. It's not available on Chrome OS. So if you want to use Photoshop, don't buy a Chrome OS computer. Mm-hmm. But if you're like most people and you want to do word processing and some PowerPoint presentation type stuff and some maybe some image editing, things of that nature, simpler stuff, you can use Chrome OS, the Chrome browser, and that operating system and be fine. What's important is that in like the era, the time period for go back to school sales for laptops and such, the market basically fell 2.5% on how many laptops were sold.
So people aren't buying as many laptops this year as they have in the past.
But Chrome OS actually kept that number up really high. In fact, they sold 175,000 units during that time period. Okay. So the operating system is now mainstream, I would argue.
So there's not only is Google stuff you can do online, but there are devices that go with Google.
You can go into a store right now, a large store that has lots of computers, like a, I don't know, one of those big stores that has lots of computers. You can go in and can buy them. You can't. I don't know if you can buy a Mac there, so you might have to go to an Apple store. You can buy a Windows machine or you can buy a Chrome OS machine. Those are both valid. In fact, the relatively inexpensive, pretty good computer right now is a Chrome OS laptop. The one that we talk about as geeks is the high-end one. It's called the Pixel. That's really beautiful, and it's very much like a Mac Pro, but it runs Chrome OS.
Has a high pixel density display, all this other stuff.
Yeah. Like but we see a few ones that are Chrome OS-based laptops, and if you spend a lot of time in Google, that operating system is great. And one of the things that's cool about it is the Chrome OS is a Linux background, underground, and therefore it's not susceptible to the kind of viruses that we see in a Windows environment. It's a safer machine. Kind of like we say sometimes, well, if you don't want viruses, just get an iPad or get a Macintosh, and you got a problem. Well, you can also get Chrome OS now.
All you have to do is trust Google with everything.
What's the problem?
Yeah, just relax
and enjoy. Says with the Google device on his face.
Yeah.
Then again, that's what we do with Apple with our phones as well, with iPhones.
There's a certain amount of trust going into giving over some of our ownership of these machines, and we'll get into that later in the next section of Geek Speak. That's the show you're listening to now with Lyle, Bonnie, and Ben, and we'll be right back.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
And next time on the 7th Avenue Project, are humans innately moral beings who sometimes break bad when things go wrong? Or are we natural-born savages who need to be civilized? Boy, that's a classic debate. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, we hear more on that subject. Cognitive scientist Paul Bloom says recent research on infants offers tantalizing clues to our moral natures. Paul Bloom discusses his new book, Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, with KUSP's Robert Pauly. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, that airs Sunday at noon on KUSP, or whenever you like, thereafter at KUSP.org. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primchen, the host chair today. With me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And your calls, we'd love to hear what you think the prime developments in 2013 have been. If you have an idea about that, give us a call at 800 855-5877. And thanks once again to Rick Philman for fielding those calls for us. So call in. Meanwhile, let's keep chatting, guys. So there's been some very beefy things that have happened. One of the most sort of like fun baubles has been cryptocurrency.
Talking like the Bitcoin movement.
The Bitcoin movement, yeah.
Ben, that's one of your passions, right?
The movement.
Well, yeah.
I find it really interesting to follow. First of all, because it's really interesting watching the price fluctuate so massively. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a lot of thought about, like, God, can't I just invent a time travel device? You know, I mean, like, what's going to happen?
You need 2 tons of negatively massed material.
So,
first, get enough bitcoins to be able to buy 2 tons of.
No, you just need a warp drive and warp around the sun.
But to build a warp drive, you need 2 tons of negative mass material.
I guess that's true. And you need a star, and you need some humpback whales. And, anyway,
humpback or blue whale? Humpback, yeah.
Humpback.
And some clear aluminum. Yeah. You just need some clear aluminum.
Transparent aluminum.
So,
nerds,
we've gone far astray of the original topic.
About? Oh, bitcoins.
Yeah, not Star Trek.
Is it the only cryptocurrency out there, by the way?
No, there are many, 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 many cryptocurrencies.
Ben, why is cryptocurrency important?
So to get a little bit more information on bitcoins in particular, we talk a lot about them in the November 23rd episode and more technically in the November 30th episode. So if you want more information than we give in this episode, feel free to hop back into those. Yeah. But basically, in a nutshell, cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, are anonymous but public at the same time. They're fast, so you can transfer money very quickly, much like you would with cash.
Without fees and stuff.
That's with kind of very low transaction costs. If you're transferring a lot of money, there's no fee at all. If you're transferring a small amount of money, there's a very small fee. It's all decentralized, which is, I think, very important.
That's the important one. I'll go into that in a second more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's also virtually impossible to double spend or to counterfeit. So a lot of people have been talking about, bitcoins and other cryptocurrencies have been used for things like drug trafficking and this and that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, so is cash. Cash has been the medium for that for a very long time, and we don't demonize cash.
We don't. So, what was that? There was like a NPR story on that recently about where is all the cash? If you think about all the cash that's been made and all the cash that we're seeing in circulation, there's a lot of cash being stashed somewhere.
Yeah, some of the cash is interesting. So you can't counterfeit bitcoins because math works. That's pretty much the summary.
That's interesting.
There.
I hadn't thought about the strength of not counterfeiting. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because we have a digital currency system right now. That's the thing that's important to understand.
But it's centralized. It's called the banks. So,
and the truth is, if you went to Wells Fargo and Wells Fargo lied and said they had more money, and then they gave you some, virtual money, because there's so much virtual, it's based off of trust. Serious mistakes can be made.
I don't remember the number, but in terms of the amount of actual physical cash we have in the world versus the amount of cash that we quote unquote have in the world, it's something like 1% or maybe it's less. Yeah. I can't remember what the number is, but the amount of actual physical bills that exist is just minuscule compared to the money that exists. But really, the money is just numbers in a database on the servers of some centralized banking institutions, and there's that network of trust there. So the decentralization is extremely important. Basically, the idea is that you own your money. Now, it's not because you hold some physical object that can be seized. It's because all of the different nodes in the Bitcoin network all agree that the money that you have is money that you have, right? So if the federal government comes to a bank and says, you know what, we don't like this Ben Jaffe guy anymore, go ahead and freeze his assets because we're investigating him, the banks will do that, or they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened before. That happens a lot. And sometimes it's for what we would call good reasons, like criminals or things like that. But sometimes it's not.
It's not possible to do that in the crypto.
It's just impossible.
Yeah.
Well, then how does that tie into the Silk Road and FBI having?
Let's do that in a second, because I just want to take the social aspect for just a second about this. Yeah. The reason why I think it's so important is a very optimistic perspective of mine of the future of what the human race will be like.
Yeah, all right, pal.
At some point, right? So let me put my magical wizard cap on for a second and talk about philosophically. Yeah. right now we're controlled by we're managed under large organizations, governments, right? We're segregated in our society by governments, and those governments control a lot of things. Like the U.S. dollar is controlled to some degree by the federal government, the U.S. federal government. But I imagine a future society where it's not as much like that, where everybody has more of a voice, where there isn't some kind of centralized authoritative thing. It's much more a consensus-built system. And digital currency is like that. And
it's basically exactly that.
Cryptocurrency, that's why it's exciting to me. Because there's no centralized, every participant is as important as every other. That is different. Mm. And that's why I think it's important. And it's mainstream in a lot of ways.
Now, because cryptocurrencies, in particular Bitcoin, that's the biggest one out there. There are also Litecoins and Feathercoins and Namecoins and other ones. But because they are so volatile right now in price, because they're relatively new, Bitcoins have only been around since 2011, the price fluctuates a lot. So right now we're seeing a lot of people using it for speculation or for investment. Yeah. So a lot of people would invest when they were $200 a coin and then sell when they're $1,000 a coin. Recently, it's gone back down. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? But the thing that's most exciting to me is the idea of having Bitcoins and actually being able to spend them.
Yeah.
There is a sushi restaurant down the street from my house that accepts Bitcoins.
Yay! You're so excited.
Unfortunately, I'm a vegetarian. So of all the restaurants.
California roll, baby.
Yeah, California roll and a lot of seaweed salad, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's my plan for sometime in January when I come back from the holidays. So I think Bitcoins are extremely important and extremely exciting, and hopefully they'll stick around and become more ubiquitous and maybe a bit more stable as well.
Yeah, and I'm more interested in digital cryptocurrency more than Bitcoin specifically.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, so can we talk a little bit about, I'm sure we have in the past, about some of those other currencies.
Sure.
You know, we've covered how relevant are they?
I want to cover one really fast, which is Namecoin. And I'm not going to get into the details of how it works, but basically the way Bitcoin works is the computational work that prevents counterfeiting and double spending and verifies transactions and all of that is basically just running through these SHA hashes, these complex math problems.
Okay.
Right?
What about named?
But these math problems don't really do anything. That work doesn't really mean anything other than just showing that you've done work. So Namecoin, actually, the work you're doing actually will help create a decentralized DNS server. So when you go to google.com or yahoo.com or whatever, have you not heard of this? Yeah, so when you go to a web address, right, what you end up doing is first you hit a DNS server, which says, oh, google.com is
DNS
actually...
DNS domain name server.
Thank you, I was just about to ask.
Yeah, and it says, oh, actually, google.com is actually at... 254.this.that.whatever, this crazy IP address. Mm-hmm. That's what DNS servers are. If you're in China...
DN servers.
DN servers, right.
Sorry. ATM machines.
Yeah. So DN servers. So that's what those do. If you're in China, for example, the Great Firewall of China will block domains or DNS... will block DNS so that way you can't figure out where Google is or where Yahoo is or whatever. If there's an open source decentralized DNS service, that means that censorship all of a sudden is a lot more difficult.
Interesting.
I love that idea.
Now, okay, cool. This year cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, kind of went public in a large way, and we're seeing some effects. And you have a news story around that, right?
Exploded, absolutely exploded. There's actually, one of the news stories is that the Silk Road, which was an online drug-selling website, recently got busted.
Not just drugs. You can buy the things, too.
All kinds of stuff.
Guns and toys. You
could you?
Prostitution, maybe? Could you?
Probably, yeah, sure. Yeah, anything illegal you could buy there.
What about fuzzy dice?
If they're illegal fuzzy dice.
Only if you place them in illegal places.
All right, fair enough.
Like you hang fuzzy dice in your bathroom, that's not legal. You can't buy those.
Their assets got seized, or at least the ones that they could get. Now, earlier I said you can't take someone's Bitcoins, right? It's decentralized.
So what about that, sir? The FBI seizing the assets of the Silk Road, which were largely Bitcoin, right?
It's kind of like you can't seize data on my computer unless you know my password. If you know my private key, you have access to all the same...
And basically, the private keys of this person that got taken, the laptop, the machines got taken by the government.
but only some of the private keys were discovered. Seized. Yeah. Oh, in fact, there is actually a good number of Bitcoins out there that he still is the only one with access to, or they are still the only ones with access to it. But now the FBI has seized all of these Bitcoin wallets and now has this gigantic Bitcoin stash, like one of the largest ones to exist.
But can they use it if they don't have like the secret codes?
They do have the secret codes.
They do have the secret
codes. That's how they were able to seize it.
They actually seized that from the computer, the secret codes themselves.
So this is really interesting to me because it means that a decentralized government agnostic currency, now the U.S. or the FBI in the United States for the government holds a massive amount of this currency. Usually when you seize assets from illegal activities,
you do something.
I think you reinvest. I'm not exactly
I'm not sure
what you
either,
do,
yeah.
but maybe you reinvest.
If anyone knows, they can call us.
Yeah. What's the number?
That's a curiosity that we have. So if you have something, you can weigh in on this story. It's 800-655-5877. Rick will pick up the phone.
And the question that we have right now is, what happens with seized assets once the court things goes through? If you've got a whole bunch of cash, drug cash, something like that.
What can the government do?
Yeah.
It is interesting to me, though, that now basically a government holds a lot of Bitcoins.
Yeah.
And I'm sure other governments do. We just don't know about it.
All right.
I
mean, so definitely,
I can imagine that they'd use it in other sort of sting operations and things like that to get in.
I would imagine that
places.
They help fund what they do with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
where can you buy a tank with Bitcoins? Or,
you know, you can buy seized vehicles. You know, they auction
that's
them
true.
Off. Right?
But for Bitcoins? I mean, I guess
can you buy seized vehicles?
Not yet. Cool. Yeah.
So, you'd have to sell. The FBI would probably sell these Bitcoins.
In fact, a lot of the stores that actually accept Bitcoin, the first thing they do is translate them to U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
Right. That's kind of.
Because because Bitcoins are so volatile right now.
So when you go buy sushi, pretty quickly they have cash.
Yeah.
They have U.S. dollars.
Yeah, pretty quickly. Should we segue from there to privacy? We were kind of touching down that road anyway, because that seems
it's
there's
funny.
Been some major developments in dings to our privacy this year.
Yeah, or awarenesses of dings to our privacy. It's been happening for years.
Yeah.
What I find is fascinating, and I wrote down, like, we want to talk about Snowden and privacy and security, and then before the show, we were trying to separate those out. And
that's hard.
It's hard.
And one of the things that's going on is that we actually these have multiple meanings, and they're conflated upon each other. So let's first talk about why government exists from a national perspective. One of the major – not why. Let's say one of the reasons government exists is to produce a feeling and an effect of security in that you can live your life without being bothered by foreign people stealing your land or external sources attacking you. Like, a major reason why I appreciate the government is to take care of those things. So I don't have to have my own weapons at my house to protect my chickens.
We don't have to do everything yourself.
Right.
There's some larger entity that's looking out for some of the things that affect everybody so that we don't, as individuals, have to.
Yeah, so
that's
called security.
And that's why
personal
zombie apocalypses are so scary, because then government goes away and you've got all these zombies everywhere.
Exactly right. All right, we'll sum that up. 2013.
Excellent.
Zombies.
All right. So that's security. We're
so that's
about
personal
the
physical security
that a government can offer.
Yeah. So, and I would call that
some
social.
People will debate whether the government is offering security or providing
absolutely.
A need for one to feel secure.
Yeah.
Personally.
I mean, there's a big debate there. Now, there's also one of the things we like is privacy, personal privacy. Like, everybody knows what people do in the bathroom, but no one really wants to know the details of what people do
in the bathroom,
right?
Yeah.
But it's not a secret. It's private, but it's not a secret. So secrecy and privacy are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird, right? Yeah. Because most of the things that I think of as private in my life, I keep them secret. But reality, everybody, as the famous book says, everybody poops, right? Like, that's a reality.
Yes.
So that's a difference. Privacy. So security, physical security, physical privacy and secrecy have these weird interconnections. Okay. Then there's the computer space where security is normally talking about patterns of keeping secrets. Encryption is one of these things. There's whole methodologies around that.
Mm-hmm.
And because we rely more and more on secrecy in what we do online, or privacy in what we do online, these tools of computer secrecy and cryptology are really important. And what we found out with Snowden's revelations of documents.
This Eric Snowden who leaked all kinds of stuff about
Edward.
What they had to say. Edward, excuse me. What did I say? Some other E-name.
Edward it is. What's come of light is that one of the ones that I think is really important is that the branch of the federal government have been intentionally, to some degree, sabotaging the systems that enforce good security online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really bad. And the effect of this has basically been for all these companies and geeky people to go, we're going to redouble our efforts, which is really good.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the side effects we have as individual users are, you know, identity theft or, you know, credit cards being missing, you know, all these effects.
Well, that's still
viruses,
happening. Target.
All that stuff's happening.
Yeah.
But because of the leaks of Snowden and showing how pervasive this snooping has been, the answer to that is to make the security better. So that's why it's kind of, these things are mixed together, privacy, security, and such. So, Bonnie, I'm going to pass off the voice to you for a second so you can kind of probe me a bit on what I'm thinking. Because it feels like I'm blabbling.
So. Well, so far we've laid out kind of what each of those individual things mean generally. Security generally, privacy generally in the social sphere and then in the digital sphere.
Yeah.
And the development that has interested me most this year is what Snowden did, right? He took information about how NSA was collecting our data and made it available to everyone.
Yeah. He took a private thing, a secret private thing, and made it public.
Yeah. And it was about...
Which is what they've been doing.
Right.
They're just keeping it secret.
Yes. In the interest of our national security.
Yes.
It does get very confusing.
That's exactly right, right? Because of we want to be safe at our home, that's why they're doing it.
Right.
Oh, man.
So, there is that debate, and maybe we can tease apart that debate, because so far it's been, to protect your security, you have to give up your privacy.
Yeah, I don't like that dichotomy. I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the reason... It's hard to explain why, but first off, the idea of all awareness government, that concept. If some omnipotent being knew everything that was going on, theoretically, they'd be able to predict potential danger, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing because that would allow them to stop that danger and protect my security of my family and my life.
Right.
So you see a potential good there. And that's the argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
First off, technically, I don't think that's viable. I don't think you can collect all data and process all data and therefore come up with good conclusions.
Well, you have to be able to analyze and process all that data.
Right.
Which that's the hope I have, I guess, that the NSA has collected so much that they're not paying attention to little old me.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, if what they could, if that wonderful being of all knowledge could act appropriately and do right, then, oh, that's great. A magical land. I'd love that. You know?
But it's not clear
I don't
that
ride unicorns, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you know, the other thing is that the idea is that this omni-being intelligence thing would actually be able to act in the best interest of everybody and not be one of the things that was potentially evil, right? That's the problem.
Well, and this is where I get confused. Does the NSA really think that they're doing it for the good of the people, or are they just really used to having... all access and abusing, you know, enjoying the mild abuse that happens from having that kind of access and just squawking because their toys are being taken away.
I see. I mean, part of the issue, I think, is although this is a very interesting social commentary conversation, I think the question that we need to really focus on first is, can the NSA, with the information that they're getting from domestic wiretapping, can they stop anything? And actually, recent news, actually, this was just a couple days ago, according to a member of the White House panel that was recently called for NSA's metadata collection program curtailing, it hasn't stopped any terrorist activity at all. And they've talked about how they've claimed like maybe as many as 50 prevented attacks and things like that. But the theory is that they're that they're mixing together the domestic surveillance with the overseas, communication overseas surveillance. So if you
domestic surveillance has stopped no terrorist attacks is what this
according to a member of the White House panel.
What?
I mean, that's pretty
damning.
Yeah,
that's pretty damning. So, I mean, even if an omnipotent being could do it, the NSA can't currently.
Well, then that's the thing that's important for me. I keep saying this omnipotent being thing is because that's what they want to be able to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's neat. I want a lot of things.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I want it. It's special. Anyway, let's talk about this some more because it's a big, beefy topic. This is Geek Speak. I'm Bonnie Primsch in the host chair today with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe, and we're talking about the big, beefy stuff. Currently on topic is the false dichotomy that is privacy versus security. We're often told
well, to protect your security, you're going to have to let me know where you've been at all times, collecting the metadata, as the NSA has been doing on domestic citizens. And Lyle, you're saying that that doesn't necessarily follow, that to be secure, we have to give up our privacy.
Yeah, and this, you know, this actually has other terms that relate in the same space are liberty versus control. Mm-hmm. And so Bruce Schneider, which is a security expert, and he's got a few books. He's Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly about Security and Insecure World.
Mm-hmm. Also, his writing on his blog is fantastic.
Yeah. And he I'm going to quote him. "I've never liked the idea of security versus privacy because no one feels more secure in a surveillance state," right? You don't feel more secure in a surveillance state, right? Mm. Okay, so there's plenty, quoting Bruce Schneider still, there's plenty of examples of security that doesn't infringe on privacy. They are all around us. Door locks, fences, firewalls. People are forgetting that quite a lot of security doesn't affect privacy. The real choice is liberty versus control.
Okay.
Okay? And that's what becomes the question, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's happening is the more knowledge you have about people's privacy and secrets, the more control you potentially have over them. That's right. The problem with
well,
the government doing
that. Well, I think that's sort of the gut-level creep-out factor,
right,
to the NSA story is... my God, have you seen me in the shower, basically, you know, or, I took a call from so-and-so and then I called so-and-so and now you know kind of what's been on my mind.
Right.
By just putting two and two together. And that's super duper creepy.
And you know, this argument, the argument to do it is all about fear, right?
Yeah.
The argument is, and maybe rational fear. I mean, there's rational fear. Don't jump off a tall building. You should be scared of that and it shouldn't be a thing you do.
Yeah.
But there's so much of that it becomes this point. It's hard to argue against it, right? We want to stop terrorists. Well, it's not like I don't want you to.
Right.
But that's the problem. Okay, let's go into technical space. We're getting kind of social structure based, and this is Geek Speak. So the side effect of what's come out by Snowden is there are active attacks against our current ways of making things secret on the net. And that means we have to redouble our efforts to make sure it's secret. That's the kind of stories that I find fascinating because, for example, there's this wonderful tool that allows you to encrypt a hard drive, and it's an open source tool. And this, once you've done this to a hard drive without having that password, you cannot look at the data. Really cool, right? If the guy that the Silk Road guy had actually had that on his computer and never shared the password with the cops, then the government wouldn't own those bitcoins. They'd be locked into a drive that no one could get access to. They'd be gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have that enabled. But it's a freely thing. What is that hard drive thing called? I'm blanking on the term.
I'm blanking on the term too.
Don't do it. It becomes a backup
blah,
nightmare.
Blah, hard drive.
But anyway, the point is that if you want to be really secret on what your data is and keep it private forever, you do this.
You can, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing that was interesting in the last month is some questions were raised. Wait a second. Who wrote the code that does that? How valid is it? So there was kind of a Kickstarter type campaign that said, "Hey, give us some money. We're gonna you cover
that,
this,
that,
right?"
That was the code on GitHub is a certain way, but then the released file is slightly different.
But not just that; it's also that no one's really looked at how the code works. It's complicated,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
And so it's possible that in that complication, some nefarious means were inserted. So they basically paid for an inspection of that entire code base.
Right.
That was the project.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. That seemed like a really healthy thing.
Yeah, and that only took place because of the Snowden leak, right? We're getting major differences on how we think about security mm-hmm. because of this social impact. Mm-hmm. So Times recently said, most important person of the year, right?
Right.
Most influential, excuse
influential,
me.
Yeah.
Most influential. They named the Pope. Totally cool.
Yeah.
The Pope's been doing some neat things.
That's legit.
Yeah. Not a geek topic, but the most important geek of the year, by far, the most influential geek of the year, Snowden. Absolutely.
He's the guy.
And I personally am in that space of he did something kind of heroic. Now,
well,
he might be a jerk too, I don't know,
yeah,
but
he
did was a good thing.
It was at least impactful, right?
It
had a huge impact on the public discourse.
Sure.
And on how people are responding to these ideas of privacy and security and what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's a big piece for me. I feel like we're going to see a better uptake on security and on online security, like how crypto works in the next coming years. And that's going to affect everybody.
Well, one thing that we've talked about over the years here on Geek Speak is just what a scourge crappy passwords are.
Yes. Okay.
The whole like 1234 thing that most people are at is just way, way short of what we need to be doing to protect.
And over the length passwords. Of over the length of GeekSpeak, we've gone through multiple suggestions on what to do. In fact, we have a great.
And it keeps changing.
Yeah, it does, and in this year, what's become evident to me is that the human mind, the human mind can't keep up with what computers can do, so much so that you can't really remember your passwords anymore.
Right.
And
your passwords are secure enough.
If you're doing it right and there's a different password for each thing you need a password for and they've got like the capital letters and the numbers and the mixy match and the not reproducible, then it's just number salad.
Right. And in this last year, we've seen a solution that I think is going to be the viable future on how authentication is going to work online, and that means how you confirm that Ben is actually Ben when Ben visits his bank's website, like how that confirmation process works. Currently, is your username and password. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be. It could be something else. When I go into my bank, I can bring my passport or I can bring my driver's license. Both of those, they will say, yeah, you're valid, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea of authentication, knowing that who is who, is a really important step. And that's going to change. What we've seen with this project called Squirrel, which is done by Steve Gibson and a lot of people, is a new way of thinking about how you do that authentication process. And what it relies upon is a computer. You have to have a computer with you. Now, mm-hmm, luckily, most of us have computers with us. We have phones.
Phones are now the computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if you want to conceptually think of what that assistant is, in the past, you've had to have a driver's license or a passport, and we've been in a world where that works, mm-hmm, because those things are kind of hard to duplicate and all that. And you could technically, theoretically carry around a book with you of all your passwords, right? A piece of paper that has your username and password for all your sites. Mm-hmm. But that becomes vulnerable. It's very vulnerable in that way.
Right. Yeah.
If somebody takes that from you or federal government comes in and looks at you and
I have a friend who has that on her computer.
Yeah.
And I don't know how secure that is.
Well, that's the thing is that how do you manage that? Because our minds can't do it anymore.
Right.
If you want to do it right, your mind can't do it. So you got to
have it
somewhere.
How do we access it, but nobody else does?
Right.
But then how do you have the computer that you have along secure enough?
Right.
And to be storing all those things?
You potentially leak that information every time you want to use. Let's say you use the, mm-hmm, the piece of paper process.
Sure. Every time you pull it out.
Every time you pull it out, you have to experience it. Other people have to share it. You might actually, put it in the wash machine on accident. Oops.
Yeah, oops.
I can't log into anything anymore. Right.
Yeah,
so you got to duplicate it. You've got problems. And the truth is, when you want to deal with large sets of data like that, the tools we use are computers. That's how we access data and manage data.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept that we'll probably see moving forward is to participate in society, you as a human being will have to have a digital assistant. And that concept is more real for me than it ever has been.
Well, and we're seeing it more and more as people rely on their smartphones, not just for information, but to fill in the awkward pauses in the social sphere. we're very much relying on digital assistants already in that way.
Right.
And you're talking about managing your passwords.
Well, here's the thought process I have. The government currently has a whole process of doing medical insurance, right? The, mm-hmm, the new process that relies on you to log in somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think your bank to participate there, you pretty much have to be online. You could probably still do the branch, but more and more you've got to be online.
Mm-hmm.
And since you have to be online anyway, you're already relying on computers to participate in society. It's not going to decrease. Right, that'll only increase from here.
Exactly. We're not suddenly going to become Luddites.
That's right.
There is also an interesting cryptography technique that I've found that's really interesting. And it's basically you take these two pieces of, we'll say, a piece of paper and a piece of clear plastic. You can put one on top of the other. And they both kind of look like noise. But when you align them exactly perfectly, then all of a sudden you can see something. It's called visual cryptography.
Right.
And it's basically the idea is each of these pixels is a black or a white pixel. And when you align them just right, then all of those form some kind of a pattern, whether that's a phrase that you can read, whether that's a QR code that your phone can scan. I mean, that's really wonderful because if anyone gets a hold of it, they need to figure out how to align it. Or if anyone takes a photo of it when you pull it out of your bag, no one's going to get that information unless they happen to be taking a picture of you when you're aligning it perfectly.
Here's the fascinating thing about that.
Yes.
There it is, paper. You're not dealing with computers. You've got a paper thing.
But
the problem
need something
is you have to generate that with a computer.
Well, that's
right?
True.
So that's what I'm saying is the boundary of what participating society is more and more reliant on computers, and it will never be less so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like right now, if you go to the county building and you do something, you might interact with a human being, but they're on a computer, right? I mean, the truth is the computer's controlling it.
Yeah.
So those have large ramifications from a social perspective. And that's become very evident this year in my mind. Going forward, password management has to be computer-based. Authentication management, therefore, is going to be computer-based. Mm-hmm. You've got a problem if you're doing that and you're not trusting that device. If that device isn't trustworthy, you've got a serious problem.
Right.
And how is it trustworthy? Well, you need to understand the code that runs it, right?
Yeah.
So when you say computers control things, you're not. That's not actually accurate. It's not computers that control it. It's the people that write the code.
It's programmers.
Right. The programmers.
So that's why I've like strong. We'll
the
talk about that.
Geeks have inherited the earth. We already knew that.
We'll talk about that in January a bit more about what you should do for 2013, but 2014. Yeah. But what I want to urge that this year, I clearly see a shift of it used to be have really good passwords. Now it's have a really good trusted digital assistant. And I don't think that's going to go away. Yeah. So the squirrel technology, which would basically you don't have to memorize passwords anymore. Mm-hmm. You do have to trust your phone. Because of Snowden's leaks, we see that those things are very vulnerable. In fact, large governments are trying to circumvent the systems in general. We're going to see an uptake on making those things better. I hope that we're going to see a forced my hope would be we'll see a forced open sourcing of all digital assistant type technology where you just don't want to have a personal assistant that you don't have source control over. Mm-hmm. That means you wouldn't trust Apple. You'd basically have a different way of thinking about your operating systems.
See, this seems like one of those two-tier things because there's the geeks who know how to tinker with the open source code and have the security of knowing I can control this. And then there's like the layperson, let's say, who just gets mind-boggled when they think of having to have open source navigability.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. So when I say open source, what it sounds like you heard from me was I would get to compile and look at it and change it.
Yeah.
That's not the important part for me. What's important for me when I say the operating system I have running on my phone, here's the source code. Hey, everybody, is there any problems with this? We, instead of trusting Apple or Google or Microsoft,
peer-to-peer trust.
We trust that everybody looking at it together will produce a good system. So this is is Wikipedia data good? Well, it's the consensus of the planet, so it's probably pretty good.
There is something to the wisdom of the crowd idea.
Yeah. And right now, you know, Ben's covered a story a few months ago or last month about the operating system that's at the kernel of the phone actually being really hackable. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's actually Verizon or somebody else, right? It's the chip manufacturers actually wrote it. Mm-hmm. That's going to have to change for a society in which we trust our devices. And I think the answer to that is culturally seeing the source code, having the open source methodology of knowing what runs on your phone might become a social imperative.
In this rosy future that you imagine, are there enough people who can push for open source access to the code so that it can be wisdom of the crowded? Who's going to win? Like, are there enough people that can participate in insisting on what you're hoping will happen that it will actually happen? Pal.
Well, Snowden helps. Snowden helps.
I mean, there might be more of that going forward.
You know, the truth is, we've been talking about for years, have a good password. Mm-hmm. People don't have good passwords.
People are still 1234ing.
I'm telling everybody, back up. Make sure you have copies. You should have at least two copies. I think you should have three copies of your content right now. Yeah. I bet you 80% of the listening audience doesn't have backups. Right. I know that right now I've got some files on this laptop that don't exist anywhere else because I'm even not great at it.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's the consistency, the machine-like consistency that's required for an individual to really kind of maintain control over their environment.
So it seems like the problem is humans are lazy, including the ones who know what they should be doing, like us. Right. We still haven't backed up the most recent files. I mean,
we also sleep and eat, and we have to go to the room that we don't want to talk about.
Weird bags of water. Just can't do anything right.
Mostly water.
Mostly water.
Well, guys,
how many quotes of Star Trek can we make?
We can cram them all in there. Just a couple minutes left of the show. Sure. What else should we let people know about before we close out this end of the year show?
Since we were talking about coding and learning to code, I did cover a story last week about code.org and some of the success.
How they do?
Yeah. So in 7 days, code.org, the hour of code, this process of trying to get as many people to code within 7 days as possible. In 7 days, 15 million students, 170 countries learned 1 hour of code.
Yes.
Wow. It is possible, this rosy future you speak.
Programming literacy is so important.
Yeah. In 7 days, the week of code, right? In 7 days, they got more students to program than Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, and Instagram combined had users in 7 months.
Woohoo!
In their first 7 months. And also, 1 in 5 U.S. students did an hour of code. More girls participated than in the last 70 years in this
That's
1 week.
That's lovely.
And 500 million lines of code.
Nice.
Windows is about 50 million
95%
lines.
Redundant because they were following a step process.
That's true. That's
go,
very
if you
true.
Have never programmed a computer, go to code.org and try it out. It's a lot of fun.
Code.org.
And while you're online, you can go to geekspeak.org too and learn all about the shows and all that.
Right, yeah.
I want to urge people to do one thing, and maybe it's code every day, but years ago, friends of ours, Bonnie, started this Fun A Day project, and I've participated a couple times. The concept is...
It's actually a national effort.
It is a national effort. That's true. In January, every single day, what you do, if you wanted to participate, you do one thing you love to do, and you do it every single day. Mm-hmm. I have done a digital art piece program every day one year. What have you done, Bonnie?
I've done little 4x4 ink and watercolor sort of illustrations of things
four
that are personally significant to me.
4 inches by 4 inches artworks, kind of, but kind of like a journal.
It's kind of like a visual journal,
And it's really pretty, right? If you do something like that every day, a lot of them suck, right? Like, that's just the reality. Is that a lot of it's like, eh.
Well, but at the end of the month, I went, okay, this one and this one and this one can go, but I still have a significant number of things that I find valuable that I did not have in the world before.
1 year, I did a portrait a day. In fact, the very first picture of the day, of the year, was your brother, Ben. Mm. But I did a photograph every day for 1 month. Actually, I did it for the whole year. Anyway, Fun A Day. Go to geekspeak.org to learn more about it. Participate in January. Be creative and do something you love.
Be creative. It could launch creativity for you for the whole year.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been Geek Speak for December 21st, 2013. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with his permission. And Geek Speak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use your stuff any way you like. Just let him know the Geek sent you. This is 88.9 KUSP Public Radio and KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. And thank you for listening. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and not, as you may have just thought, then Amy Goodman. My God, I talked very fast.